Well, hi, welcome. I hope you're each doing great. I wanted to just check, are there any questions or reflections on our first seminar? Any clarifications or follow-ups about what you might find useful for us to discuss, even if very briefly, at the beginning of this seminar before we move into it? Anything at all from last seminar that you have as a thought or a question? Anyone? Well, let me, while we remain at an open mic, and thank you for managing the background noise, I want to do a brief reflection on what we're going to be talking about today and an application of what we focused on last time about us as coaches understanding the concept of listening to our clients and their stories. Now, remember, the story that the client is creating to that client is not a story, it's just the way things are. And that's the same for your client, protege, collaborator, employee. That's why I think it's useful to have a system to understand things. And this is what we're going to be talking about the remaining three seminars, is the roadmap system. And a roadmap is simply an acronym for the seven steps of understanding and deconstructing a story, of looking at the algorithms in a practical way to understand and work with our clients to help them understand and revise a story. So it's a systematic way to write new code for mind, brain, and behavior to optimize that story. So again, the roadmap system, and I'm wanting to say this now while we have a time for any questions about it before officially moving into the recorded version. It's an acronym for the seven steps of this systematic way to deconstruct and understand personally constructed stories and created stories, and how to strategically create new behavior. So this is an application of algorithms, which is simply a finite series of steps to solve a problem. This is also why we never have to go back into the past or look at the origins or the dynamics previously or the history of something, because anything, everything that's important for a client is going to manifest in the conversation with you. Every aspect of how they're successful, every facet of the interferences for that, conscious and unconscious, are going to appear in the conversation. And I'm going to put us on lecture mode because not everybody is hearing the hold on 1 second. Okay, we're on lecture mode now, so you don't have to worry about the background noise. And I want to complete this just brief overview. So this system, this roadmap system, is a simple way from a coaching perspective, I believe, to understand and change a story or create a new one. This system is simply one blueprint of story construction to understand and address the mind and brain creation of thoughts, feelings, and behavior organized into a story. So this is a deconstruction of the personally created stories. So here's your biggest challenge. You don't, your client doesn't, always consider that everything you think, feel, and experience is your creation at that moment. The story that you're creating, just the way things are for your client, protege, as well. That's why we need a system. So here are some things to consider just as an overview before we talk about this specific system. The most recent contribution to an aspect of this process has been for some, especially researchers, to systematically examine our decisions and our judgment. Here are some examples. And a lot of this research began with Daniel Kahneman's work. And in a just released book, he co-authored Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment. So here are some examples. We make different choices in different states of mind. We invest differently when we're calm, rested, well-fed, and alert, and different from when we're upset, tired, hungry, or bored. That includes just about every decision we make in areas other than investing. Another example. Doctors are 15% more likely to order breast cancer screening for patients they see first thing in the morning than those just before lunch. And a final example, I promise. 208 federal judges differed by an average of more than 3.5 years in the length of the prison sentences they recommended. So these are just some considerations, and I'll give an example whenever we have time. It may be today about how to use something like these studies in actually working with a client. So I want to keep that in mind because I saw that some of you are wanting examples and applications, and that's exactly what I want to do, is to make this really practical so that you can use this in coaching and use this with yourself for really looking at your experience and applied here your money story. So to what we should be talking about, our first application will be to examine the initial aspects of the system that I'm referring to as the roadmap system, the acronym. So we've discussed your money story and the concept of writing a new money story. Now we're going to look more closely at how to do that, the principles and practice of change step by step, and specifically the essential steps of change to create a new money story that can be successful and filling and fulfilling. So these are the initial step. This is the overview of the roadmap for a new money story, the seven steps that roadmap is the acronym for. And these sound so simple, but they're not always that simple. Remember, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. First, recognize authorship. You're writing your money story from assumptions to every choice about earning, spending, saving. Own your story. Accountability is a prerequisite to change. Third step, assess the plot and storylines. Use that recognition and ownership to then assess the plot and the storylines. In other words, is it working? Recognize the behaviors, messages, and the language of mind and emotion that go into your story. And we're going to do this. You've seen the exercises and work tools to do it. We're going to apply those and discuss it in more length. This is just simply the overview. Then, fourth step, decide what to change to make an informed choice about what you keep, what you let go, what you change, what you enhance. Next, map changes. This is some of the essence of what we do with coaches, is to create and sustain success stories with our clients, strategies especially. And then to author new experiences, create the new money story. Finally, to program new identity. This really deserves some attention because it's so important to incorporate and sustain the changes by a corresponding internal growth. So here's the key concept of this last step. Our identity is the most powerful force in our psyche. Whenever we change or do something different, unless we incorporate it into seeing how and who we are, unless we incorporate it into the model of how we do things, we'll revert back to the old behavior. So this is so important with a client, because that change and transformation that you're helping them to co-create, that needs to be incorporated in their model of how and who they are, their identity. And we'll talk about ways to do that. So in this seminar, we're going to discuss the first three steps of the roadmap and the other steps in the subsequent two seminars. So first, recognize authorship of your money story. Now, this seems pretty easy, right? Remember this premise, though. Every moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. Every day begins a fresh page. Now, our brain doesn't know that because there are some things on autopilot. In fact, your brain's job description is to convert repeated behavior to an automatic process, a default mode, so you don't have to use as much energy doing it. So what this means in one sense is practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. You keep doing something again and again, it will become the default mode. So we want to be sure it's the right thing, and if it's not, that's the challenge of not continuing that automatic default mode, but trying something new. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So, how can you tell your money story to yourself to know what to keep and what to change? So first, there are four principles in recognizing authorship. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. So the takeaway here is you're listening for what the assumptions are that your client has to see if they're working or not, if they further the story or not. If a client assumes that the client needs confidence or experience or to be comfortable before they proceed, it's not going to work. That's not a way you began. So that can be a limiting assumption. Here's a story. Because our beliefs write the software of our behavior, which is why we want to listen for beliefs. In other words, we see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. An example. Two anthropologists, and this is a true story a number of years ago out of Oxford, were chosen to live essentially for 1 year in as identical ape colonies as could be found. They lived and observed for a year. They were chosen because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. They didn't communicate at all. And then at the end of the year, the two anthropologists were extracted from the ape colony to compare notes. Now, they and their research teams expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. The anthropologists and the colonies were as close and similar as possible. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a real unity and comfort with the ape colony, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony, remained careful, vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never reached a harmony. And they puzzled over these findings. For months, the research teams could not find a single account of the differences. Finally, they found one thing, one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed, he never used it, but the apes also never knew that he used it. So how could this? But he knew he had it. The other anthropologist had no gun. He had the assumption he was going to make it or break it on his own. For the anthropologist who had the gun, he knew that if things got tough, he had an out. And that compromised everything. The anthropologist who had no gun got remarkable data because he knew he was going to be on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. we tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is a mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle two, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality, and even some things you have to believe in order to see. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. A story can actually define possibility. And you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was seen as scientifically impossible that it would cause death if someone actually did it. Then, in 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Now, within the next 18 months, 12 other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. And today, this is commonplace. High schoolers do 4-minute miles. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. In fact, right after the finish line, Bannister collapsed and passed out. He was revived immediately by smelling salts, and when he opened his eyes, the first thing he said is, "Am I dead?" Because that was the prevailing assumption. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, what we register, and then how we process it. We construct our storylines from these premises. So what that means is we have to bring our beliefs about money, finances, and wealth into conscious focus, as well as the processes of our decision-making to see how well it works in present time. Here's one example. A couple married a week after Black Friday, beginning the Great Depression. The poverty and scarcity of their situation centered on the reality and the metaphor of the Depression-era finances. Money was elusive for this family of 7 children, and they often struggled even to have enough food. But they were proud that they never had to go on relief, which is what welfare at the time was called. This required the father to be away for several months at a time, finding work in other states. Finally, after years of being exhausted and tired, the mother agreed to accept relief. Around this time, she had bartered canning vegetables for almost 3 years to have her home painted. Someone in the welfare agency passed by and saw her freshly painted house. He called her and wondered, how could she afford to have her home painted? Do they really need to be on relief? And this proud woman said, just take it back then. I don't want it. For this family, money you didn't earn had strings attached. Their experience of the scarcity of money became a legacy amalgamating their life and money stories. 3 generations later, her granddaughter was going through a post-divorce move and adjustment with a difficult financial time supporting her 2 children, but she was adamant about not asking for anything. She was determined, quote, not to become one of those people who took welfare. She carried the same torch of pride as her grandmother. And she said, one of my children refused to eat the free lunch that she was offered at school because choices were limited. Her great-grandmother learned that you gave up certain freedoms with a free lunch. I'll tell you a footnote about that story later to stay tuned for. So the choices we make as parents are models that our children emulate. They look, experience, take unconscious notes. These notes get passed on. For example, what money means to your parents that you saw from earliest times there were words in a language, what money meant to them, what they thought they could do with it and couldn't do, what they regarded money, meaning how they regarded people who had less and more, all kinds of things get subtly, these unconscious notes get passed on. And so many beliefs and behavioral patterns are downloaded in these first years of life without even conscious recognition. Principle 3. A new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discover that when you measure people's present intentions, you affect their future behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. When you ask a client at the end of a session, what will you commit to do in the next week before we meet again? And that immediately follows what their basic summary of what they're taking away from that session. So they put their takeaway in an output channel, and you're asking them, what do they commit to do? Not, I'm going to try, I need to, I should, I ought to. What will you do? Here are some examples. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates in the next 6 months of 35% over those who were not asked, matched as best as possible. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if someone intends to eat certain foods to diet or what will they do for their wellness, what do they want to do to fund their retirement plan. Remember, hope isn't a strategy. A good idea isn't a plan. Principle 4. We'll come back to that. Our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. A series of studies reported by Dr. Dan Gilbert of Harvard showed that volunteers a word appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. It was such a short time that they were unaware of the words that were shown. It was 1/50th of a second. They couldn't even pick it out in a series of multiple choices afterward. No, there was subliminal programming. But yet they were influenced by a word flashed a 50th of a second subliminal programming. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk or move more slowly. Then, later, these volunteers were asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did. When the word stupid was flashed, they would perform just slightly less on a test. And they really didn't know, but actually they made something up. They considered the facts they were aware of and came up with some reason. For example, the volunteers who walked more slowly came up with reasons like, well, I was a little tired when I did the test. I just traveled, I was jet lag, or haven't been sleeping as well. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect, but that's the way our brains work. We see closure. Same thing happens when you ask a client a why question. You're moving them from the flow of their experience and describing that to their left prefrontal cortex of logic and reason and intellect. They're always going to come up with a reason. So first, that disrupts the flow. It moves them from the playing field to the observer's platform. And secondly, most likely the reason that they attribute is not accurate, because it's not designed for accuracy, it's designed for believability, but especially to bring closure so you don't leave something open-ended and uncomfortable. So keep that in mind. These findings demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure, for our brains to end any dissonance by imposing certainty, for our minds to complete a story by a causal explanation for both closure and effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth. kind of like a finish without an ending. And this is also how confidence and clarity create an experience of trust in the listener. I'd suggest you do the four exercises of step one to be sure you get the foundation of really recognizing your money story and your authorship of it. And remember the basic ideas of any story, the plot, essentially the core themes and storyline that inform what you look for and then how you attribute meaning to what you find. It's there. It's there in your algorithms, so it might as well be something you look at, understand, and then you have the option of deciding to act on that in a continuing way or to do something different. The storylines, your money story is your stealth statement. Every time you make, use, or save money, you're making a self-statement. Every time you talk about money or the economy, you're making a self-statement. Second step, own your money story. Review, I would suggest, the assumptions and motivations that construct storylines. That exercise on page 2.5 of the workbook. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet, a health club membership, or just good facts, will not have an impact unless you change the software. And we'll come back to that in just a moment from a different perspective, but so as we examine a storyline, how it's constructed, here's an equation that might be useful to you for yourself and in coaching. And this is in the outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So anytime you hear or recognize a behavior that isn't working, look at the antecedent, the belief that drives that. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs can also be constructive. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have the experience. I don't make enough to save anything. So first you have to recognize each experience as a choice instead of just the way things are. So here's a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. So the third part of that equation, beliefs drive behavior, behavior drives performance. If performance is not working in the way that you want, look at the antecedent. What are the behaviors that need to be adjusted or applied in a different way and understand the beliefs that drive those behaviors. So I want to apply that now by looking at two aspects, the point of reference of your story and active versus passive positions. And these are in the exercise or applications of the exercises. Can you make and enjoy money and money myth? So first, point of reference. The point of reference is a basic component of storytelling and writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. This can include passivity or resignation or just a theme of helplessness. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. So here are some examples of those with an external point of reference. And I would emphasize, as I'm listening to a client, each of these would be a coachable moment. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening. To be reacted to, well, there's nothing I can do. they're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than initiating or creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. That's just the way that I am. They may believe that they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. Now, remember, these are not blanket assumptions, pervasive things. This may be a specific reaction to a specific issue. It may be about a certain person. It may be about money, but not other things. So listen to the specificity of these characteristics of an external point of reference. Or they may believe they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. Or if they, for example, experience a symptom in their body, they medicate it away. It's like seeing a warning light on the dash and disconnecting it rather than pursuing the problem. Now, contrast that with an internal point of reference. This is what we're coaching toward. An internal point of reference is in the context of a growth mindset. So they have an experience of effectiveness. They know that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. So here are some characteristics. And again, these are what we coach toward. To recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. If they experience an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result, then look for alternatives. If they see a result that doesn't work, they simply decide not to continue. They decide what to change and then initiate that change. They also realize the menu of choices is created. You can choose and you can choose how you choose. So their experience is effectiveness, ultimately of mastery. Now here's another aspect of what we can listen for in our clients and be helpful simply by highlighting in a collaborative way these aspects. Because sometimes, for certain clients, an aspect of the story seems to just write itself, to just happen. So here are some examples. And again, each of these are coachable moments. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. I can't seem to put money into saving. It just seems to keep happening. So you have to eliminate all the outs. Remember, the anthropologist, the idea of a gun was enough to change everything. These passive positions can disown a feeling, a thought, or an action as an act of creation. And it can even seem as if the feeling you create makes you its victim. For example, my anxiety stopped me. My doubt paralyzed me. The feeling or the experience you created, then if you see yourself as the victim of it, and that's sufficient reason to stop, then you have a stuck story. Now, here's what happens dynamically. Someone gets a signal of anxiety or discomfort about taking a step into new territory, and they stop themselves and then instantly make sense of that stopping by creating a reason that makes it make sense. Now here's the challenge we have as coaches. Every step of every client into new or different territory, even a small step, is going to be attendant with anxiety, uncertainty, trepidation, so they will need our help, not only in resonating with that, understanding it, but a help in framing it in a correct way. As we talked just a bit last time, someone experiences anxiety and excitement in exactly the same way. Their brain can't tell the difference. If they began to take a step into the new, the different, the unknown, they've never done it before, they can't be sure it's going to be, they can be pretty sure it's not going to be a repetition of the past unless they stop and recreate it. So how you frame something determines how you proceed. If you frame that brain activation as anxiety, that means you better head to cover. That makes it make sense to stop. Well, I avoided danger. If you frame it as excitement, as challenge, as opportunity, then you look for a way to proceed. A different part of the brain engages the challenge, the excitement, to create new neuronal networks and connections so that you proceed and experience that excitement of the newness instead of the anxiety of what seems threatening. Same activation, how you frame it, determines how you proceed. So, a story can become an identity. I'm a risk taker, I'm a bargain hunter, I'm a procrastinator. If someone characterizes a cluster of repeated choices, also called a habit, as if it were an identity, it makes it harder to change. So to me, that's a coachable moment. Well, you know, I'm a procrastinator. Let's look at your choice at that instant to decide to stop and not continue, and then to look at that frame by frame. So review the exercise, 17 common money storylines, and look at those storylines yourself as objectively as possible, not to judge or criticize, but to just inform and question in the same way you would inform and question a client without a judgmental, critical, pejorative framework. So now, once recognizing and owning a money story, first two steps, third step, assess the money story plot and storylines. Now, here's what we know from neuroscience. A belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. It's a physical part of a neuronal network. And you can't just say, a teacher can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from a student's brain. You can't just list three reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network and neuronal pathways. Or just a new fact is going to override the one already there. But change can occur. It's a process, not an event. It's an inside job. So this step to assess a money story plot in plot lines includes examining beliefs, asking questions about assumptions. What's another way of looking at this? How might this be limiting you to think of it in this way? Are there questions I'm afraid to ask? What do I really want? What do I need to let go? So another aspect of this is to distinguish two fundamental building block aspects, needs and ideals. These are two brief exercises beginning page 3.5 in the workbook. Needs and ideals are at the core of identity. I often, with a new client, will ask them to do this exercise that you see as 3.5. To do the exercise to look at their top three needs and top three ideals and send them to me before our next session. And I will actually print these, the three for of each, and put them inside the chart, my folder for the person, because it's going to help us both incorporate their needs and ideals. Their ideals are their core values. Those are part of an identity. It's going to help to know, for both of us to know, in creating strategies and goals to incorporate needs and ideals so that all of someone is going in the same position, same way. And then, since needs are essential requirements, that distinguishing wants from needs can also be important, because you can never get enough of what you don't need. Now, let's look at comfort zones as a concept of what we work and how we work in coaching. Remember the thumb exercise we did last seminar? That's an example of a comfort zone. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once it gets established, it resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. The temperature increases or decreases just a degree or two. It signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We even have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar, even if we don't like it, even when it's uncomfortable. So a comfort zone actually is misnamed. It's not necessarily comfortable. It's just familiar. It's predictable and automatic. Our brains have rewired, and our mind software knows to predict the outcome. That can be misread as effectiveness, but it's simply repetition. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program, a savings program. A comfort zone can be a repeated role you play in a relationship, or procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make, or establishing a structured savings plan. So a comfort zone can manifest in certain patterns, storylines, recurring characters. Now, for example, working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating the excitement of procrastination with a grand flourish at the end with all the stimulation of adrenaline and cortisol can become habituating, and someone can define that as being a procrastinator and then ending with a grand flourish, but it's an habituation both to the pattern and to the stimulation of those neurochemicals, and then the relief that's even more so when you finally do complete it just before the deadline. So this can become a comfort zone to repeat the same pattern. Here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound winnings, to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners of $3 million or more file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Still, their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, they ended up returning to it. They put their original thumb back on top. Here's another example. A simple Irish woman lived an ordinary life in a small village for over 4.5 decades. Then suddenly, she vaulted onto the world stage with Britain's Got Talent. One of the initial results for Susan Boyle is that she became understandably overwhelmed and had to be hospitalized the day after competition. She wasn't sabotaging herself. She just got overstimulated and didn't have a plan for her success or even a model for her success. She, like the lottery winners, got an overload way beyond their comfort zone. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to stay in it. The choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone, but a comfort zone can trade passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. And remember, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. So, to break out of your comfort zone, your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. As someone gets more successful, they may feel vaguely uncomfortable, just different. The results go outside their experience, their model, even their self-image, and it cues an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Your brain has a mind of its own. So part of the assessment of your money story here can include understanding conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. And with the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. And we're often not aware of having them. We just assume that we see things the way they are. So a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict, like the example we talked earlier, a surface and a shadow story. For example, to continue the most recent illustration, if you read an anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as danger ahead, or uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. A current paradigm reframes the excitement, even the trepidation of moving ahead in new territory, as a signpost of progress. Another example, we need to be afraid of the right thing. We fear what's easily and readily remembered. We fear what we can't control. It's a lot more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, we feel no control. It's an availability bias, a prediction based on greater emotional charge. Here's another example. Smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. People fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. So, a question here. Are you afraid enough of not having abundance in later years to plan and save sufficiently for it now? There are a lot of studies that show money is not related to happiness and many other things it promises or represents. But here's one relationship as you think about saving for the future. The one thing money influences for all groups and classes of people, choice. And one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means we can learn from our experiences and from experiences of others as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created that old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We created them. We can think about these things, reflect on them, and examine our paradigms to see if they work and serve us well. Our behavior, simply asking, does this work? We can assess our money stories in some basic ways, monitor our choices, question our ideas, probe, look closely at our reasoning, ask clearly and honestly the bottom line, no matter how fancy the theory, does this work? Now, here's a quote for the guys, because we're inevitably the ones who will not stop and ask for directions even when we're hopelessly lost. I know these things. C.S. Lewis said, "We all want progress, but progress means getting nearer to the place where you want to be. And if you've taken a wrong turn, then to go forward does not get you any nearer. If you're on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man." Notice Lewis even said man. Now, here's another way of saying this. You always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So it would be immensely helpful to know specifically what those goals are, to see which ones you want to keep, enhance, let go, and avoid. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. If you want to change, focus on the system. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. So is your savings account. And this is why, for example, over 80% of people who lose significant weight gain it back, at least, because they changed their weight. They didn't change their software program, their body image. Now also, listen to your language and of your clients in regard to your goals. If you say you'll try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says there's not a full commitment. There's a trap door, a potential diversion to other alternatives. You know the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These takeaways, these distractions create an out. When someone says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know that person's going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. And this is what you want to nudge coachingly your client to do at the end of the session, to put something into action, to begin the sentence of their commitment. I will. So, well, I'm going to try. What will you do? So, a couple of words about creating a new belief before we stop. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so much or so often that they achieve a status of becoming a personal myth. Well, if I were just loved more, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently, return to it regularly. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. Here's a brief story to illustrate how the value of what we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Nathan Handworker. Now, you know this better be a good story with a name like that. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1960 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious, probably more so by most accounts, as his competitors, but he priced his at 5 cents. The other hot dogs at that time were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior and attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. The free products furthered the perception that the value must be substandard. Then Handworker came up with a new idea. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand nearby and stand around eating their hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes. And he raised his prices. His hot dogs started selling. People assumed that if physicians were eating his food and it cost a little bit more than his competitors, it had to be good. So they began selling well and became a national phenomenon. Nathan's famous hot dogs. They're still around. And I'm asking at the end of that, what are you charging for your monthly retainer as a professional coach? Think about it. Somebody will ask me, what do you think I ought to charge? What are you thinking about charging 3 years from now when you're full, things are going great, you feel totally confident? What are you going to charge as a monthly retainer then? They'll tell me. I said, set that up this afternoon. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take a period of time. It can occur quickly, or it can be a process that takes years. The process of changing a belief is just that. It's a process, not an event. It can be planned, though, systematically, step by step, with incremental progress. It's your process, not anybody else's. Don't compare your inside to somebody else's outside. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, and your progress with someone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it work. It's not a competition. It's not a comparison. But ask this of yourself, and you will find times that this question will be useful to ask clients. You can always tell the difference between dosing, timing, and titrating from procrastination, which is this. In changing your belief, the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind and your brain. The choices generate moment by moment the life that you create. The programming of your internal map of reality, your software, determines how it will be. At any moment in time, neural networks are influenced, your brain, influenced by three factors: genes, experience, and focused attention. We actively engage someone to create a new story with all three of these. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. DNA downloads its information from expression of its code. We now know it can go in the other direction. Our experiences, our beliefs, can turn genes on or off to determine the major extent of the expression of most DNA-based information. That's how powerful a new story can be. A final thought. Actually, two, because I want to add one here. I just decided. Here's the initial final thought. What remains unconscious will be attributed to fate. The other, as coaches, we never, as I've mentioned, have to go into the past, the history, the dynamics. Everything that's important will manifest in the conversation. Every algorithm that determines thought, feeling, behavior, action, attachment patterns, other kinds of patterns, will manifest in the relationship. You will have an in vivo way of looking at that experience, that expression with your client at that moment. So the key is to have a working alliance where you can get away with saying whatever you need to say to get your client to collaboratively look at that with you. So I'm going to take us off of lecture mode. If you'll manage the background noise, I want to hear if there are any, I know we just have a brief time, any questions or comments. Okay, we're in discussion mode. Any thoughts or questions or clarifications about anything we just talked about? I hope I'm incorporating, in a beginning way, answers to the questions that a number of you sent in, and I appreciate that, and I said already, it really helps me know what kind of things you're interested in, and I want to incorporate that in our discussion. Feel free to send in other questions, thoughts, in an email, especially if you couldn't be here live time and listen to the recording, send any questions to me in email and we'll discuss them. What I'd like to do, if you're interested and you want to do this, to hang around after our final seminar, week after next, for a bit to have more of a conversation, just a discussion, and we'll get to anything that we didn't get to on the subject, or to look at additional questions and thoughts, and just to have a discussion of the things you'd like to add or ask. So thanks very much. I appreciate your responses, your emails, and questions. Keep those coming. I welcome them. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves. Have a great rest of the week. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Absolutely.